buying a home in Northeast Florida. A new investigation says it's a lot easier if you're white. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend. We are always live on the radio at 9. So make an appointment listening. And make sure to listen to our podcast, too, on iTunes, Stitcher, or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, Kept Out, the new investigation by Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, showing who has the toughest time getting a mortgage in this city. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, why one Florida county dropped its invocation at its county commission meetings. Plus Cole Pepper on an emotional Daytona 500 over the weekend. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's an important new investigation into what's called modern-day redlining in American cities. And it finds that African Americans and Hispanics are about twice as likely to be denied a home mortgage here in our area, Northeast Florida, than their white counterparts who have similar financial conditions. This from a new investigation by Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. The show Reveal, which is heard here on 89.9, reviewed more than 30 million mortgage records across the country to come up with these results, and the findings were verified by the Associated Press. Emmanuel Martinez is a data reporter at Reveal with the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, and is on the line. Emmanuel, so good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. We want your thoughts, comments, and questions about Kept Out, the new investigation from Reveal showing that if you're Black or Hispanic in Jacksonville, you are twice as likely to be denied a home mortgage. It's 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJackson. We're already getting your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. We'll go to those in just a few minutes. Emmanuel, for years this was called redlining, banks just not wanting to lend to people in distressed neighborhoods. This investigation, though, I think it's fair to say, is what many are calling a modern-day form of redlining, that it doesn't matter where you live, your data shows that if you're African-American or Hispanic in this city, you're about twice as likely to be denied a conventional home mortgage as a white borrower who has the same sort of financial picture, correct?
Yeah, that is what my analysis shows, that, you know, it's specifically in Jacksonville that people of color, specifically African-American and Latino borrowers, are more likely to be denied a conventional loan. Even when holding income and the loan amount constant, and even taking into account, you know, where the borrowers are looking to live. And, you know, that is constant or persistent among 61 metros across the country. It's not just in Philadelphia where we focused our investigation. It's not just in Jacksonville. You know, it's happening in cities around in the South, in the East Coast and out in the West Coast too. It's happening in big cities and small cities. It's not just happening in one part of the country.
Right. This is an investigation that's national in scope, and you went through records that are publicly available under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. Just looking at virtually every time any American tried to buy a home by trying to get a conventional mortgage in 2015 or 2016. By conventional, did you define that, Emmanuel, as a 30-year fixed mortgage?
Yeah, that was the traditional mortgage that, you know, does not directly involve the government, that's not backed or insured by the government. So we did not look at FHA loans, VA loans, loans secured through the Rural Farm Agency. This was just conventional loans when the government not directly involved. We wanted to focus on the conventional mortgage market because that is seen as the gold standard, and we wanted to look at, you know, the access people of color have to the conventional mortgage market.
And if you're just tuning in, as we look at Reveal's new investigation, Kept Out, what's being called modern-day redlining in this country, Why it's still much more difficult for people of color to get a mortgage loan. What are your thoughts about this? Particularly here in Florida, where in the aftermath of the financial and housing crash, this is such a sensitive topic. Home loans. We want your calls. 549-2937. Okay, so you controlled in this investigation for 9 economic and social factors. The applicant's income, the amount of the loan, the ratio of the loan to the applicant's income, the racial makeup and median income of the neighborhood where the person wanted to buy. You tried to control for this to isolate whether there were other factors other than race or ethnicity contributing to people being denied a mortgage. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so especially on income, because income varies between people of different races and ethnicities, and income is one important factor in terms of, you know, whether someone gets a loan or not, we wanted to reduce that influence and hold it constant among all the applicants, as well as the loan amount. So what my analysis shows is that by holding it constant, people who make the same amount of money, who are looking to take out the same amount of loan, that when you hold those things constant, when two people walk into a bank or a lending institution to ask for a loan, the people of color are still more likely to be denied. And redlining in the 30s and 40s, you know, was based on race and geography. So we also felt it was important to look at the neighborhood, look how much the median income of the neighborhood compared to the median income of the surrounding area. Look at the demographics of the neighborhood. How black is the neighborhood? How Latino is it? All these factors, particularly those last two, weighed in heavily, you know, back in the 30s and 40s in terms of who was getting loans and who was not. So that's why we felt it was important to add those as variables into the analysis. So that's what we were doing. That's, you know, what factors were pertinent in terms of why someone is denied a mortgage.
And in fact, certain neighborhoods in Jacksonville, if someone's coming in for a loan app and they're African American, depending on the neighborhood they're coming in from, they have a better chance of getting the bank to say yes. Isn't that what your analysis is showing?
When we looked at Philadelphia, just as a case study, the analysis did show that, you know, the more black or the more Latino a neighborhood is, the more likely a loan was to be denied in there. And I can only speak to Philly. But what I also have seen by looking at the data in various other cities, like I know this to be true in Philadelphia, Memphis, and even in Fresno, California, that there's a pattern that I've seen, and I'm sure it's happening in Jacksonville too, that neighborhoods of color there are more loans being denied in neighborhoods of color than there are loans being made. And even when they are being made in neighborhoods of color, those loans are going to white applicants.
Now, something else that's come out of your reporting, and I'm looking here at follow-up reporting on this from the Florida Times Union. As communities have continued to spread out, particularly here in Jacksonville, which is a very spread out city, they've continued to segregate. And inequality continues to be exacerbated in part because some banks don't open branches in neighborhoods where people struggle to get a home loan. As we are learning in the wake of your investigation, the bank that's near the top when it comes to equitable lending in Jacksonville, you know, lending equitably across all racial and ethnic groups, is Bank of America. And so Ira Goldstein, who's quoted in the Times Union story, he did an extensive housing analysis of Jacksonville a few years ago. He's saying people need to look at the banks that are doing the kind of outreach to the community that BOA is and are opening branches in all parts of town as one part of the solution to this. Now, is that an analysis you would agree with?
Some of the cursory looks that I've given at bank branch analysis, and what I've seen, again, what I've seen in Philly and then in my hometown of Fresno, looking at the data in those two particular areas, most bank branches are located in white neighborhoods. So when you think about, you know, access to mortgages and, you know, even applying one, where are you supposed to go to apply for a mortgage if the nearest bank branch located near you is across town and you don't have reliable transportation? How are you supposed to get there? I do think it's important for bank branch locations to be in all types of areas. What I was seeing in Philly was that, you know, the 3/4 of those branches are located in white neighborhoods. So where are people of color supposed to go to even apply for a mortgage if there's no bank?
Let's go to a few of your calls as we look at Reveal's new investigation. It's called Kept Out. Before we go to the calls, I'm just going to read one email that came in from Mark. He says, I've been a licensed mortgage loan officer since 1989, and I will respectfully say that if you have a minimum required credit score and have the income and assets, your ethnic makeup has nothing to do with getting approved. I'm a proponent of social programs that help level the playing field, but I can sincerely say that mortgage lending is color blind. I'll have you answer that in a minute, Emmanuel, but first let's go to Bob in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Bob, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I run a nonprofit which provides vocational training to disadvantaged youth at risk. We train young men and women who are not employed right now to become merchant seamen. We've trained a few people who are in the age to buy a house, and our tracking, 100% of those people that went to buy a house were approved for a mortgage. Wells Fargo seemed to be the bank in the Jacksonville area on the north side that has been approving most of those mortgages. I'm questioning the depth of this investigation. It doesn't jive with the data that I personally see. Thank you.
All right, Bob. Emmanuel, how you compiled the data. Could you explain that again?
Yeah, so this is all the data that was, this is data that's reported by the banks and given to the government. It is data that, you know, lending institutions are required to keep and report. And it is required under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. And it includes every type of loan. So, and again, we just looked at conventional mortgages because that is the gold standard in terms of, you know, a mortgage. And also our reporting has shown that they were, in the past, people of color people have been forced into FHA lending when they otherwise qualified for a conventional loan. So while Wells Fargo specifically, maybe those were all FHA loans. Maybe, you know, half of them were conventional, half of them were FHA loans. Again, the analysis that we did just focused on conventional lending.
Keith in Riverside. Hey, Keith, happy Monday.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy Monday to you. I'm interested in this topic because I've been in Jacksonville for almost 40 years. And as a naval officer, I was denied a loan in the 80s. And the mortgage lender called me and said, Mr. Green, there's no reason this loan shouldn't have been approved. I'm moving to another company on Monday. Please call me and I'll get you a loan. And I did. And he all but told me it was because I was black. So the facts are pretty evident. I believe this gentleman's data, and I also believe that discrimination in housing goes as far back as housing in America. So I've written a book about some of that, and I included it in a book that I just recently wrote. And I think people need to pay attention to the facts as opposed to what they actually believe.
All right. Thanks, Keith. And so, you know, a moment ago, we got an email from a mortgage loan officer. And by the way, Emmanuel, he followed it up with another email saying 90% of our applicants apply online these days. They apply over the phone. So he's pointing to that as well. But what about Keith's story? And here is another email from Jay. This is white privilege in action. When white people say, I don't have privilege, or I don't believe it happens that much, this is just one face of it. Because it's all about money. As an African American, I pay my taxes and bills like everyone else, but I cannot always access the same level of incentives or benefits, even when my qualifications match or exceed my white counterparts. Not being able to buy a home or get other kinds of loans means a business we don't get to start, a kid that has to struggle to get to college, a medical event that may bankrupt a family. And so clearly two points of view here, but your contention is that the numbers don't lie because you looked at this in the macro. You looked at this nationally.
Yeah, and again, nationally, and we held income, the size of the loan, the ratio between, you know, how much the borrower was looking to take out compared to their loan. So when we hold all those things constant, when we look at, you know, people who have those same financial characteristics, people of color are still denied at higher rates. In Jacksonville, if a non-Hispanic white applicant and a black applicant walk into a lending institution and they make the same amount of money and they're looking to take out the same amount of loan, the black applicant is still more likely to be denied. I think that's a problem.
And by the way, your analysis showed if they're over in Gainesville, they're four times as likely to be denied.
Yeah, and again, it's, we're seeing this throughout Florida. Gainesville, in Tallahassee, in Orlando. This is not just, you know, this is not an issue just in Jacksonville. It's all over Florida.
Okay, here's another. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was also going to say, you know, just because my analysis doesn't show up any other places in Florida does not mean it's not happening. It just means that, you know, there were populations vary in size and by income and the demographics. So there are probably other factors that we needed to take into account that, you know, those places probably needed a more specific or tailored model to highlight this problem.
Here is another point of view on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Kyle says, here we go again. So now we're going to force banks to change their credit guidelines again like they did under Clinton, then create more Freddie Macs and Fannie Mae's to back up the risky loans at taxpayers' expense. We all saw how well that went last time. Either you have good credit, qualifying income, and 20% down or 0% for VA and a low debt-to-income ratio, or you don't qualify. So what about that? The idea that, in his view, this argument is opening the door back up to lending to applicants that may not be 100% qualified. What about that point of view from him?
I will say that we found many people in Philadelphia, where we focus on our investigation, that put 3 to 6% down on a conventional mortgage when the standard is 20%. And most of those applicants were non-Hispanic white applicants. So the fact that, you know, it's not always, you don't always need to put 20% down to get that conventional mortgage. Banks were lending in these historically black neighborhoods to white applicants with a lower percent down payment, with a moderate income and credit scores. It's just that these things don't necessarily apply to if you're a person of color.
Chad is in Mandarin. Hello, Chad. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. It's Chad Harris. How you doing?
Oh, good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. So just wanted to call in. I tuned in a little bit late, and I'm a realtor, and I'm black. And I myself have purchased three properties since I've been living here in Jacksonville. And I'm not here to discredit your research. I'm not doing research. I'm only going off of anecdotes. And I have seen that, unfortunately, a lot of my clients who are Black and African-American, they do seem to have a difficult time getting qualified. Not to generalize, because I have some Black clients that get qualified just as easily or quickly as their white counterparts. But what I see is, like, there seems to be more of a prevalence of financial literacy gaps when I'm dealing with some populations in the Black community. And I think a big problem is the credit system in itself isn't all that intuitive. So I deal with people that have, you know, great income, their DTIs are fine, but, you know, something happened in their background, whether it be medical, whether it be school, and they don't really understand what needs to be paid and what can be neglected in order for them to get over the hump. And unfortunately, a lot of lenders or financial institutions aren't really providing those counseling and education services so that people have equal footing. I feel like, unfortunately, in a lot of our households, you know, financial literacy isn't something that's
All good points from you, Chad. Thank you, Chad. Chad Harris, a realtor. I'll give him a little plug there. look him up and give him some business. Thank you, Chad. What about his points, Emmanuel?
Well, I mean, again, this goes back to bank branch location, right? I know someone said that, you know, there you can get mortgages over the phone or over the internet. But over the internet, you know, you need internet literacy. And then even if you have that, you need a good connection. So there are many barriers to that. And on top of that, if it assumes that you have some sort of financial literacy, that you don't have questions that, you know, are better explained in person. So this also goes back to access. Are people able to walk into a bank branch and ask the questions and get the help that they need?
There's so much more that I would encourage everyone to look at as part of this Reveal investigation through the Center for Investigative Reporting. Just go to revealnews.org. Emmanuel Martinez, data reporter at Reveal, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Yeah, not a problem. I will also just quickly add that we've also developed a tool where you can look at the lending breakdown in your specific neighborhood. And then that is by texting the word loan or préstamo in Spanish to 202-873-8325. And you can get the lending breakdown of your specific neighborhood and compare that to the demographics of your neighborhood.
Excellent. Thanks for that as well. Well, much more still ahead later, an emotional nod to history at the Daytona 500. Culpepper takes us to the track. But up next, prayer at government meetings. Why one Florida county is now holding a moment of silence instead of an invocation. That's next.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Wouldn't it be nice to know what's in the local daily newspaper, even if you have blindness or diminishing eyesight? WJCT's radio reading service can help. You'll hear what's in the Florida Times Union every day, articles, op-eds, obituaries, even the comics. Sign up at wjct.org/radio reading, Our thanks to Florida Eye Specialists, Delta Gamma of UNF, and the Radio Reading Service volunteer readers for giving voice to the printed word.
Looking for an echo.
We are always looking for that perfect echo in the doo-wop revivals, Sunday at 8 and Monday at 9. We play the best in doo-wop, a cappella, and a little mix of soul.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/hd.
Welcome back. Well, it's an issue that has affected local government bodies nationwide. Sectarian prayer at government meetings. Down in Brevard County, commissioners there dropped their religious invocations from the start of their meetings after a federal judge issued an injunction banning the county from doing so. The judge ruled the county's invocation system violated both the U.S. and state constitutions. So as a result, they're now doing a moment of silence at the start of their meetings. The ruling came after a coalition of people and groups in Brevard sued the county after the commission declined to allow atheists, agnostics, and others to be part of the invocation rotation. They based their lawsuit on a 2014 Supreme Court ruling that said invocations at local government meetings are permitted so long as everyone can participate, and that would include those of no faith. Now, two of the plaintiffs in the Brevard County case, Jocelyn and David Williamson, are the co-founders of the Central Florida Free Thought Community, and they will be speaking about this tonight in Jacksonville. They join us now in studio with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for being with us. And so you sued over this in Brevard County, Jocelyn, because you felt that this was not an inclusive way to start the government meetings.
That's correct.
And you based it off the Supreme Court case.
Yes. Just looking at it from, a humanist perspective and general human dignity, you know, having everyone be represented in a meeting is really important. So, for example, if you're going to the city council and you've got a pothole and you are of a minority faith or a non-faith position, and you may not want to participate or you feel excluded at the beginning of the meeting, how comfortable are you going to be to ask to have that pothole fixed? Just to kind of give it a real world spin here. It's meant to make everyone feel welcome, I think. That's what an invocation should do. It should tell us to turn our phones on mute and focus on the tasks at hand.
David Williamson, for now, the Brevard County commissioners are starting their meetings with a moment of silence after this ruling, but they're appealing this decision. They would like to go back to doing traditional religious invocations, right?
That's right. And we didn't ask them to stop holding invocations. We just simply said we want to be included. And we had to say that twice before we received our first unanimous decision, 5-0, by the council or the commissioners there saying, nope, you can't do it. And the Anti-Defamation League got involved and sent a letter and said, hey, let them do it and let everybody do it. As the decision in 2014, the Greece decision you refer to, the Supreme Court decision requires, it said, quote, even an atheist can participate. And that's all we were asking for. Of the more than 20 government bodies in Central Florida that we've requested, Brevard is the only one that said no. And specifically, they said no because you don't believe in God.
So the source of their discomfort was allowing atheists to participate, not necessarily non-Christian faiths. Is that right?
Not necessarily. During the deposition process, and some of these quotes were actually used by the judge to demonstrate that they had a preference for the Christian religion, they had a preference for monotheism, and they had some concerns about anyone other than monotheists doing invocations.
Okay. This is an issue that has vexed, I think it's fair to say, local government bodies from coast to coast, including here in Duval County, where this issue of sectarian prayer, it tends to flare up from time to time. Although I don't believe, and I'm sure someone will call or email me if I'm wrong here, I don't believe there's been a lawsuit filed in Duval challenging the practice at our city council meetings. Although, depending on who's city council president at any given time, the invocations can be more or less inclusive. And so this is something that it seems to be very, very different approaches all over the country, Jocelyn, depending on the makeup of the community, who's sitting on the government bodies, whether or not someone like yourself decides to challenge it.
Definitely. And I think in the case of secular humanists and atheists, they feel, I would say, almost scared to come forward. They don't necessarily want to have that kind of conflict. But the fact is that the local communities and the people sitting on the commission or the council are going to have a strong impact on what's actually done. And I personally think it's a shame that they don't really want to be that inclusive and they're not considering everyone that's in their community.
One of the Brevard County commissioners was quoted a couple of months ago as saying, after the judge ruled against them and said that they could not continue, they ruled in your favor. She said that Christians are being discriminated against by silencing Christian prayer at these government meetings. What's your response?
Well, if someone thinks that this is an attack on religion, they have to remember who we sued and who we beat. We sued the county. We didn't sue that commissioner's church. So this is not an attack on religion. This is an attack on the influence of religion in government. And if someone feels like there's an assault on their religion, they need to remember that. And if they feel like there's an attack on their religion in government, there's probably too much religion in their government body. That was the case in Brevard.
What would you say to those as well listening who might argue, well, why is this such a big deal that you felt the need to go to all of the trouble of a lawsuit? And it wasn't just your group, the Central Florida Freethought community. You joined with some other individuals and groups on this.
Yes, we did. I Space Coast.
Freethought. Yep.
Yeah, Freethought Society was a part of it. I think that you... It is so much more. This invocation, as I talked about with the pothole example, this is so much more than just reflecting a religious belief at the beginning of the meeting. The point is, we should be inclusive. This is government for the people representing everyone. The people that have been voted into office are there to represent every single person who lives in their city or their county. And if they're doing this, if it's 95%, a Protestant prayer, are they truly representing everyone that's there? And I would also say, can we not be welcoming to everyone? Are we not evolved mm-hmm. enough to reach a point where we can welcome everyone to the table?
And this process is very divisive. Everything, we can pretty much agree on everything, Melissa, when we step into a room together as a community, the big picture items, right? There's going to be details that we disagree with, but we have to come together at the beginning of these meetings. And nothing divides us more than when we divide ourselves up into religious groups. And that's what happens when you walk into that room. Now, fortunately for the people that are Protestant Christian, over 90% of the invocations that we've tracked in Central Florida are Protestant. However, they're only less than half the population. And a third of the population almost is non-religious people. So a third of the population, including staff, including commissioners, are alienated by this process. So you can't go to a pep rally and be not on the same team as the person that's leading the pep rally.
Do you feel the solution is giving all groups, including those of no faith, a chance to deliver either an invocation or a message at the start of each meeting? Or do you feel the best long-term solution is what is currently happening in Brevard County, which is a moment of silence before the government meeting commences?
I would say a moment of silence is definitely the ideal, because in that case, everyone can take that moment to reflect as they see fit. And that is... Also, I would say from a logistics standpoint, for the city, for organizational purposes, and the amount of work that the city clerk has to do, a moment of silence is the easiest thing to do. To me, the next step is, okay, if you're going to have invocations, then they should be representing residents of the local community.
Yeah, and if they're going to happen, then we're going to be involved. They should expect atheists, Satanists, Scientologists, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, everybody should be involved in that process.
I think you forgot the Wiccans.
No, I never forget my friends in the Wiccan community.
Well, this is such a fascinating discussion, and you can hear more tonight as Jocelyn and David Williamson speak at the meeting of the First Coast Freethought Society. It's tonight at 6:30 p.m., and they meet at the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Church. That is on Manresa Avenue in Jacksonville. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Still to come, Culpepper on emotion running high at the Daytona 500. But up next, a unique new model of care for those who are really sick in St. Johns County. We're going to tell you about that right after this.
buy a home in the same neighborhood. One's white.
We could easily get pre-approved for a mortgage up to almost $500,000.
One's black.
I was really sad and just like so defeated.
And it's happening to people of color across the country. They're missing out on home loans that white people are getting. On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. It is a pathbreaking new program to care for patients in St. Johns County with advanced illness. Flagler Advanced Care Services is being billed as the first collaborative effort of its type in the area between a hospital and an insurance company. Here with more, we welcome Jason Barrett. He's president at Flagler Hospital, St. Augustine. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Susan Ponder Stansel, president and CEO, Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Good to see you, Susan.
Thank you.
So kudos, Jason, let's begin with you. You're launching Flagler Advanced Care Services. This is a unique partnership, and it's my understanding this was modeled after a similar program out in California. The first of its kind in the Southeast. How does it work? What's this all about?
Well, thank you, Melissa. This is a program where we are addressing fragmentation. And if you were to ask me today, the number one issue in healthcare is fragmentation, meaning siloed care. Mm-hmm. Part of what we've been working on at Flagler and St. Augustine for over 10 years is this concept of value, where we all talk about increased survivability, patient experience, but also how do we also reduce the burden of the cost of illness. So we live in a Medicare bedroom. 60% of the patients we see are Medicare patients. But we also recognize for advanced illness, it really is the most appropriate care setting is not the ER. It's not in the inpatient setting. And we all have personal experience in dealing with loved ones that have moved into advanced illness. So working with our very, and by the way, in healthcare, you know, nobody has the balance sheet strength to own all the means of production. We had to be in a position working with key partners to how do we address this very specialized population. So working with our community hospice partner, and Susan has been very much an advocate of this advanced illness model, which we are titled as Flagler Advanced Care, we're focusing on these patients that are truly in this late stage of chronic disease. But we're positioning ourselves to provide a really advanced care team so that these folks are in a position to advance their care, still continue to with this, and I think you know we should not understate the value of dignity of care, that they are in a position where they have the dignity and ability to choose the care setting for care.
And let's talk about how it works. This brings in the unique model involving Alivia Care. Tell us about Alivia Care and how it's helping these patients.
Well, Alivia Care is another branch of the community hospice business. And the reason that we call it Alivia Care is that, unfortunately, when people hear hospice, they automatically associate it with death. And this program is not for people who are hospice eligible. This is for people who are further upstream but are beginning to really suffer burdensome symptoms or illnesses that relate to their chronic illness. So we wanted to take the principles of hospice care, which really work very well for anyone who's dealing with a serious illness, and really teach what we have learned over the 40 years of practice, which is taking the patient as a whole person, not just a diseased body, working with their family members and their caregivers, and really making sure that patients have access to information from an informed source about the care that they're receiving.
And this model seems to work, Jason, because you're lowering the readmission rates. These patients mm-hmm. keep having to the hospital. that tends to jack up insurance prices. Mm-hmm. It just tends to drive up the cost curve overall, mm-hmm. right?
Well, you know, when we think about where these patients were receiving care in the past, they were receiving them in the most costly care settings, the emergency room, the skilled nursing facility, the hospital. And I realize how absurd this sounds coming from a hospital administrator, but we don't want them in the hospital. We want them to be, we are now in the business of health, not sickness. So we have to start thinking about working with partners that provide those care settings so that we do reduce the burden of the cost of illness.
You want more than anything for these folks to manage their conditions and be at home as much as possible. That's the big goal, isn't it?
That is, Melissa. And one of the things that is important, and we all know this, but I'll say it out loud, our medical care system now is really designed to cure and restore people. And for those whose illnesses can't be cured and their health can't be restored, the only option they have now is to go in and out of the emergency room, get admitted to places where they really are not only not getting better, but in many times it's making their illness worse, and it's certainly lowering their quality of life. So this is an option that people have for palliative care, which doesn't try to cure their illness, but really very aggressively manages the things that cause suffering.
You're a few months into this program, hope to expand it, sounds like.
We do. We think this, and frankly, I've told Susan this, I think we've cracked the code. I think this is the type of approach to manage chronic disease.
That's pretty exciting. Do you think other hospitals will follow your lead? Because you sort of modeled this after Sutter Health in California.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
They've led the way nationally.
This is the program out of Northern California, but they did model. They were the pioneers in advanced illness. We think because we have a very unique medical community, it's really just one medical ecosystem. So we're in a position to probably advance in a way that others can't. But we do think that this is very much a scalable enterprise that should be extend beyond just St. John's County throughout the greater First Coast.
Yes, and Melissa, from our perspective, we wanted to develop this program because we understand that we need to be able to work with payers, managed care companies, and we know that Medicare is changing, so we wanted to be prepared to offer something that would bring high-value care but low-cost care, and that's really where we're going.
How can people be part of this or find out more?
Well, to reach Flagler Advanced Care Services, the number is 904-417-6052. And for the more technically adept, you can go to flaglerhospital.com and search for Flagler Advanced Care Services.
Thank you both for sharing this with us. Great stuff to hear about these innovations for our folks in St. John's County that need this type of care. He's Jason Barrett, president at Flagler Hospital St. Augustine. Susan Ponder-Stansel is president and CEO of Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Thanks for joining the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
A quick break, and in a moment, it was an emotional nod to history at the Daytona 500. Culpepper has a look at that and the rest of the weekend sports. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9, and we'll be right back.
Slavery played a major role in America's development. We know that, as adults. But how do we teach our children about it? Some schools still struggle to talk about slavery. One recent textbook referred to slaves as workers. So we still have a problem. It's hard history. Is there an easy fix? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air...
I like you exactly as you are.
We mark the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on public TV. We have a tribute and listen back to Terry's 1984 interview with Fred Rogers. Also, actor Doug Jones, who plays the sea creature in the Oscar-nominated film The Shape of Water. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Arrests by Immigration and Customs Enforcement are on the rise.
ICE itself is bragging about how it's making these what they call arrests at large.
But deportations are down. We find out why. Plus, the latest on the investigation into the deadly mass shooting at a South Florida school. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Venture capital is a man's world, like, really.
You're asking people to come pitch you in a swimsuit, and, like, I'm literally pregnant, and I actually can't come into your hot tub, and I actually can't drink your beers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Katrina Lake, she of Stitch Fix fame, on female entrepreneurs getting male-dominated money. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, it was an emotional nod to history at the Daytona 500.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Peppers here now with a look at how the 500 finished up and the rest of the weekend sports news and notes. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. You know, in NASCAR, like a lot of sports, numbers matter. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a uniform number. In this case, of course, it's a car number. And yesterday's Daytona 500 was significant because of a number on the car that wound up leading to the win. 20 years after Dale Earnhardt drove the number 3 car to victory lane, and 17 years to the day since Earnhardt's death at the track, the number 3 car again took the checkered flag at the Great American Race. Austin Dillon, driving that number 3, didn't lead until the very end of the race, but took advantage of a tight finish and a late wreck, he may have had a little something to do with that, to take the checkered flag to win the Daytona 500 for his second career victory. And it was all the more significant because his grandfather, team owner Richard Childress, who was Earnhardt's team owner as well, brought that number 3 car out of retirement for him to drive. He wound up winning with his grandfather there in the tower, watching his grandson win. After taking the checkered flag, Dillon did a power slide across the Daytona logo on the grass, just as Earnhardt did 20 years ago when he finally won the Daytona 500. I will also point out that Bubba Wallace, just the second African-American to run in the Daytona 500, finished second, and he was driving the number 43 car. The number 43, of course, was the number driven by Richard Petty.
Yeah.
So to have Earnhardt and Petty sort of historical connections, 1-2 at the 60th Daytona 500. There was something poetic about that.
Pretty cool. And Wallace finishing second, that is the highest ever finish for an African-American driver at the Daytona 500.
And I right? will, yeah, yeah. I will, it is, and I will say that they're somewhat tongue-in-cheek that perhaps it was only fitting that a guy named Bubba did so well. It just happened to be, you wouldn't necessarily expect the highest finish for an African-American to be a guy named Bubba, but it turns out that, and he's a terrific young driver, by the way, and a guy who I think is going to make a big impact going down the road. I will also say that it's sort of a transitional year for NASCAR in many ways. Danica Patrick ran her last race.
Right.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. is retired.
That too, yeah.
He called the drivers, start your engines. Jeff Gordon is in the broadcast booth. So we're seeing sort of this new generation start to develop. It was the second youngest field, including 17 of the 40 drivers who were in their 20s.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, it is a short window career for them. Danica Patrick finishing 35th in the field of 40. So sort of a disappointing day for her.
Yeah, she got caught up in a wreck, as has happened so many times for her. She will run one more race in her career at the Indy 500. Although she did say, when I talked to her on Wednesday at Media Day, never say never, but she expects the Indy 500 will be her last professional race.
All right. Well, for all of those who might have gone down for the race, it was a really special weekend. And so let's talk about a few other sports news and notes. Cole's tracking for the week. Thursday, it's JU versus UNF.
Yeah, and it's the final regular season game for both teams as they play for the third seed in the A-Sun. It's big because the third seed not only gets a home game in the postseason conference tournament, it also keeps them on the other side of the bracket from Florida Gulf Coast, who's been the dominant team there. This game will be played at JU. UNF hosted the first game, and the Dolphins went to UNF and won back in January in the first of two meetings. So we'll keep a close eye on it. It should be a good competitive game there. The Armada, meanwhile, spent some time this past week opening up a new brick-and-mortar retail location at the St. John's Town Center.
I saw that just yesterday.
Yeah, and a neat shop in there. And if you have if you're a soccer fan or kids who like to play soccer, it's a great place to stop in and kind of get that soccer vibe going. But it was also something I think really served as a symbolic reminder that the Armada, despite the tumult with the North American Soccer League. They're still here to stay. And I talked with team owner Robert Palmer, who's really trying to do sort of a bold new thing. He's calling it Division Zero, really trying to find a way to help the smaller community-based teams take that next step and grow the game of soccer from the grassroots up. It has gotten some pushback from some of the establishment, but Palmer says that's really not his intention.
You know, my original intention was just to come in and focus on creative solutions for the Armada, you know, and the first thing was to try to bring financial stability to the club, you know, which we did, and then to bring the best possible quality of play and to make a run at the NASL championship. Obviously, circumstances have shifted now, and I have to solve a new set of problems for the Armada to achieve the goals and the vision that I have for it and the vision that I think Jacksonville has for it. And I'm a problem solver. When something's broken, I can't rest until I feel like it's fixed, and I'm going to do whatever I can to try to lead this charge for community-based soccer, for community-based pro soccer. We have an amazing community-based amateur soccer leagues in this country, almost 100 clubs in the MPSL, other, you know, UPSL. There's this huge groundswell of community-based support at the amateur level, but the U.S. Soccer Federation's pro league standards have prevented that community-based soccer from moving into the pro realm, and that's really what the Division Zero philosophy is all about, and that's what I want to support going forward.
People here will say, this is a bold new kind of idea, but it works in other countries. I mean, Germany...
It's the world's game. Yeah. You know, if you think about it, the way that U.S. soccer set up the pro league standards looks more like an NFL than a traditional soccer across the world, football across the world. Basing things on owner's net worth instead of community involvement, that's an NFL-like way to approach this. And there's nothing wrong with that. NFL is the gold standard in this country for sport, but there has to be room for something else. And in no way do I want to tear down the establishment or change MLS or anyone else. I want to give community-based clubs an opportunity to play pro soccer, and that just doesn't exist right now. And we want to be the charging force behind that.
Just interesting to hear what he is trying to envision. We'll keep a close eye on this story going forward.
Sure will. Thanks for that. He's Cole Pepper, and that's our show. I'm Melissa Ross. 1A is up next. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.